Welcome, guys, to the Behind the Show podcast. My name's James Gearing, and this is episode 133. And I am so honored to have on the show this week retired First Sergeant Matt Eversman. Now, Matt was portrayed by Josh Harnett in the movie Black Hawk Down, and he obviously was an Army Ranger who fought alongside so many brave men in the Battle of Mogadishu. And this conversation was incredible, yet I feel we barely scratched the surface of Matt's story and his philosophy and lessons learned. So I want to preface this introduction by saying that there will be a part two, and I would love to travel down to South Florida and actually interview Matt face-to-face in that second episode. So we discuss an array of topics, from kind of lessons learned, leadership, ownership, the effect of reducing budgets on, you know, Army, Special Forces, Fire, Police, and there are just an array of topics, and obviously the events of that day. So as I always say, please go to iTunes, subscribe, rate the show, leave reviews, and the most important thing is just share. Share this episode, share other episodes if you've loved them, and help get this project and these amazing men and women's stories to every single person around the planet, because I think they need to be heard. So with that being said, I introduce to you retired First Sergeant Matt Eversman. Enjoy. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show, and I want to give you the full rank initially. So you're retired First Sergeant Matt Eversman.
Yep, James, that is spot on.
All right, good, because I've made some military faux pas in the past, so I want to make sure I nail it. I called Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman Lieutenant Dave Grossman once, and it was corrected immediately.
Well, you know, it's funny, and like everything, it's like trying to learn the hierarchy to the fire department for an outsider. It's never bothered me. To this day, people still call me Sergeant Eversman, and it just confuses them trying to explain First Sergeant and the difference. It's like, you know what? I'll take a reduction in rank.
All right. Well, I always like to start at the very, very beginning, and obviously, I would love to talk about, you know, the specific battle that you were, I guess, most well known for. I don't want to focus on that the whole podcast, though. I want to talk about some other areas and all the years and years of service that you had after. But I also would love to find out, you know, who you were and what made you the man that on that day was put in that position. So where were you born?
Okay, yeah, I'm a native New Yorker. I was born on the South Shore of Long Island truth be told, 1966, 52 years old. So, yeah, I was a suburban New York kid, youngest of four children, just going about my business, doing the same knucklehead things that everybody does in young life, and wound up moving to Virginia for middle school and high school. So that's kind of where the story really begins. But I must tell everybody that I am a New Yorker by birth.
All right. Did you have any military in your family?
I did. You know, interesting. My dad was born in the 32, excuse me. And so when he graduated from college, he was in ROTC when everybody did ROTC, but too old for Korea, too young for Vietnam. And but he did a couple of years overseas. And then my oldest sister, she wound up becoming a nurse in the Army for a couple of years. And then one of my brothers was an engineer in the Marine Corps. But I'm the youngest, the baby. I was and also I'm proud to say the only enlisted soldier in the family and the one that stuck it out the longest.
All right. So then aside from his time in the military, what else did your dad do as a career, and what did your mom do as well?
Yeah, no, my mother, domestic goddess, just the epitome of a mother and a homemaker. She kept the whole family going and ran that ship just the way it was supposed to be. When we lived in New York, my father, like all the other suburban fathers, pretty much worked in the city, took the train in to Manhattan, worked downtown on Wall Street, and then got the bug of becoming an entrepreneur. So we moved to Virginia and bought a small farm and eventually had a little lumberyard and a hardware store.
Oh, brilliant. All right. So then when you were young, did you have aspirations to become a soldier or join the military?
I, James, I say I did, and I don't mean that like it was predestined as much as I think every certainly in rural Virginia, the idea of you know, everyone for whatever reason wants to be a Navy pilot or Marine. Why, I don't know. No offense to my Navy and Marine brothers and sisters, but I just sort of, you know, no one ever thought about, hey, I'm going to go be a Ranger and an infantryman or a knuckle dragger. I'm going to serve. I'm going to do something really exciting and glamorous. So aviation kind of always seemed like it. But, you know, as life goes on, it came closer and closer. I realized, one, I didn't really have that desire, and two, probably not the aptitude either. But I did want to serve. And I think that, to answer the question without rambling too much, the idea of service was always kind of there. And, you know, just giving back a little bit. I don't want to sound more noble than I am by any means. But, you know, that was kind of never seemed unnatural, I guess, is my answer.
Right. And then as a young man or as a child even, what about your athleticism? Were you a sportsman?
That's a loaded question, because if I say I was, I would tell you, you know, I played at a lot of sports, but I don't think I was ever that good. But much, you know, like, and I hate to sound so vanilla, James, but this, you know, you compete like everybody else does. And you're youngest of four kids, of course, you got two older brothers you got to fight with all the time. And, you know, I would say just the normal. I think I was it maybe average, if not a little bit above average, but, you know, by no means a star in any particular sport, though basketball kind of became my big passion. You know, I think I would put myself in that, you know, I held my own. Not a starter, but a good sixth or seventh guy off the bench.
All right. And then your journey into the military then from high school.
Yeah. So, I like to call it, it's my Sante raid. You know, it's the most successful failure I've had. I wound up, you know, going to college for a couple of years right after high school and really wandering. You know, I like everybody, and I don't want to dismiss it. I really probably shouldn't have gone on to school, but I did because I thought that was what was expected. And wound up studying economics and French, of all things, for a couple of years as my grades deteriorated by the day. And at the end of my junior year in college, the administration very kindly put me out of my misery and asked me to take a sabbatical, which turned into my Army enlistment and a 20-year career. So I really have them to thank for bouncing me out of school because of my poor academics. But, you know, what it showed me was that I wasn't mature enough for college. I really didn't have any burning desire to do it anyway. And while I was on this forced break, literally, I remember a buddy of mine came into the lumberyard and hadn't seen him since we graduated high school 3 years prior. And he, it turned out, had left school, enlisted in the Army, and was in Germany, back when Germany was still divided. And I can remember listening to him over the course of selling him, you know, some sheetrock and 2x4s, you know, stories about being in Berlin and being on the Czech border. And man, that just lit the fuse, pardon the pun.
Yeah. Now, well, you mentioned college, and I heard you talking to Matt Best on his podcast not too long ago. And it's something that I've also talked about as well. And I've gone through our higher education system here, and my wife is going through it right now on route to optometry school. But I think that there are some careers and some people who that path almost makes it more difficult to reach the profession that they're trying to get to. And I heard you mention about, you know, that and trade schools. What's your opinion of our, and this isn't like a political opinion, but just of our college system versus vocational school, and maybe is there any direction that we should be pushing that in the future?
Yeah, listen, that's a phenomenal question. And I think it has nothing to do with politics and everything to do with reality. I think that, listen, you, as I read your bio, have seen the differences in systems from the UK to the United States. Some things better, some things worse, but we get here and there's just this expectation that we all have to go on to secondary education in order to achieve this American dream. And what I realized, and I like to think that I'm a living proof, that you don't have to. There's no requirement other than what we put in our own minds to that says you've got to have a four-year degree in order to be branded as competitive. I believe that somewhere we lost our way with the trades and we fell out. Maybe it was in the 80s and all the greed of that big money. But, you know, listen, at the end of the day, we need really great service industry, you know, people. You know, we need great painters and roofers and shinglers and plumbers and welders, let alone mechanics. We need them all. And somehow we've gotten to this point where no Americans seem to want to do these jobs that require, you know, a fair amount of brute strength and a definite amount of street smarts and brain power in order to execute, you know, a particular operation. And that's what, again, I believe is the trade. So like it matters that I go on record saying, I think this whole idea of going to college is overrated. I think it's been blown out of proportion. I think there are plenty of kids that can go out and be supremely successful without a college degree. Now, you know, I just say one more thing and shut up. This idea, though, that, hey, listen, I don't have aptitude to be a stockbroker. I mean, I realize that. It's the reason I had to enlist. I don't understand macro and microeconomic theory. I just don't. It's like demolitions. I don't understand it. I see it, but I don't know how to do it. So in order to say, hey, Matt, you know, you're a knucklehead without a college degree, go to Wall Street. Well, clearly that logic doesn't work. And there are some things that require us to have credentials, I think is really the applicable word, in order to kind of participate in their reindeer games. But as a whole, I don't see any reason why any young man or woman should feel obligated to go into that much debt after graduation in order to start living the dream. I think we got to re-educate our employers. We got to recalibrate, and we got to get people thinking like there's an amazing pool of talent that are constantly coming out of colleges and high schools in this case that you know, with the right mentoring, coaching, and training are going to deliver. And one last thing, I'm lying through my teeth when I said that last thing was my last thing.
Please.
I'm an asshole sometimes. This is by all, neither do I want to sound like anyone that goes on to college is wrong and that all colleges ought to be burned to the ground and that they're horrible institutions. I really, that is not at all what I'm saying. There are some young men and women that absolutely should continue. They have the opportunity and they will flourish and grow and, you know, expand their mind. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's probably a good investment for some. You know, we've got to raise the watermark on education in this country anyway. We've got a lot of jackass dummies running around that, you know, could stand to have some more education pumped into their brain housing groups. So if you're listening, and I don't mean to offend anybody about not going to college or going to college, but I just say it's at the end of the day, it's not a requirement for success.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that we're seeing in the fire service where for promotion now they're requiring, you know, 2 4-year degrees, of which I have. So it's not a barrier for me, but that's almost creating an environment where people that haven't maybe walked the walk and got the skills in the profession itself are fulfilling this administrative criteria and getting degrees in, you know, whatever, and then being able to promote and then having a complete disconnect from the actual profession that they are now leading.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, it's one of those, I guess, like everything, you know, with the right balance. You know, you start a business or you go into business, it's important to learn the fundamentals of economics and, you know, how to read a balance sheet and how to do all that stuff that you might not naturally learn on the job, you know, in your trade, and learning, so like you said, some organizational skills and management skills and, you know, how offices and in this case, maybe a firehouse should be run and managing all that. I mean, of course, you know, learning how to do that might require formal education. It absolutely is. And listen, as I've said before about some of my dear brothers and sisters at arms, There are some kids that were really great young soldiers. They were good machine gunners. And they just didn't have the aptitude to advance for whatever reason. They weren't going to be able to elevate to that next echelon. And that's okay, you know, but just we got to understand that, you know, we've got to find that happy balance in between, you know, the technical and tactical skills in order to advance. And I'm sure in your world that, you know, there's plenty of jackass chiefs running around there that, you know, ain't smelled smoke in a long time. Much like in the Army, there's a lot of generals that have never fired a pistol or a rifle in a long time, but, you know, take the good with the bad.
Yeah. Now that brings me to another point as well. I, by choice, have never promoted because I just love being a door kicker. You know, I mean, in the fire service side, you know, it kills me to think I'd be outside the house fire instead of inside looking for someone. But there's obviously a huge amount of my peers that are, you know, wanting to get to those officers positions and doing very, very well. But one of the things that I have a problem with personally is that in order to be a leader, you need to promote. And my personal opinion is that you can be a leader at any rank and not have to start accumulating bugles to call yourself a leader. What's your perspective on that?
100%. You know, like I said, I was an enlisted soldier. At the time, I had enough college credits that I could have gone to officer candidate school, you know, to be promoted from within, to become a commissioned officer in the Army. And, you know, a lot of my mentors were really pushing me hard to do that because that seems like the natural progression. You know, you're an enlisted guy, you now become an officer, you become a platoon leader, on and on. And hey, at the end of the day, you're going to make some more dough. There's no doubt about it. And that sounded really, really tempting to me until it really started digging in deep on one of those moments of clarity that happens every once in a while where I realized, you know, mathematically, while I will make more money, my time with troops will be significantly limited. And like you said, you know, you would be outside, you know, watching people run into the fire as opposed to run into the fire. And at the end, I'm like, you know, I don't want to just be a lieutenant and platoon leader for 8 months. I'd like to be a squad leader and platoon sergeant for 3 years. Like that was really for me at the end. That was what it is. I want to stay with the boys. I wanted to, you know, keep doing and be a, you know, kicking down a door and doing all the things that soldiers do. So I'm right on board with you exactly.
Right. Well, let's talk about your journey through the military then, because you didn't initially go into the Rangers, did you?
No. This was one of those typical stories that I'm sure, you know, anybody, any veteran that might be listening has been down that. You know, you go to the recruiter thinking one thing and you walk out the door getting another. And, you know, I pinch myself sometimes looking back, just the dumb luck of how it all worked out. My idea had always been, though, to become a Ranger. I'd seen it on, you know, a 60 Minutes show that back in the early 80s, they did a profile of it. And I'm like, man, that's really, really cool. They look high speed. And, you know, I joined the Army and wound up on a what they call an open contract, which means after basic training, they could have sent me anywhere in the world. There was no guarantee of anything on the other side other than I was going to be an infantryman. And again, I didn't know any different. So I'm like, oh, you know, okay, that must be how it works. And, you know, the grace of God, I was the basic training cohort that enlisted when I did, all unbeknownst to us, were tagged for a brand new light infantry unit up at Fort Drum, New York, the newest element of the 10th Mountain Division, which was being I don't know what the doctrinal word is, but, you know, the 10th Mountain had gone out of business after World War II. And in 1988, they were bringing it, unflagging, uncasing the flag, the colors, that's what it is, uncasing the colors and instituting the 10th Mountain Division. So our whole basic training battalion was sent as one cohort through basic training, through AIT, and then up to Fort Drum to start a whole brand new unit from start, which really was actually very cool. And it was a great introduction for me into the military and into the infantry, and just absolutely loved it.
Right. Well, it's funny. You just reminded me of a story. I don't know if you ever met Pat McNamara. He was Delta.
You know, I have not. I know this name, but I do not know him.
Okay. Well, he's just, you know, appears to be the exact same type of man that you fought alongside with in Mogadishu. But when he enlisted, his dad actually sent him with a lawyer. So that the lawyer actually looked over the paperwork and made sure that when he finally signed it, it was exactly what he was trying to get. I'd never heard anyone say that before.
That's funny. That's awesome. Well, good for him and good for his dad for thinking that, you know, to make sure that they're not, you know, doing those rascally recruiting things that they do from time to time.
All right. So then how did you then get from there to Ranger School?
Yeah, so while I was up at Fort Drum, you know, brand new unit, the Army was throwing a fair amount of dough at it so we could get all the, you know, as many military school opportunities out to the ranks as possible. So, you know, I actually went to sniper school first. We had to go with it while I was up at Fort Drum. I got sniper school, volunteered for Ranger school. And with that, you get airborne school. And then I went to SEER school, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape school. You know, and all this in the – which was interesting, all in the conventional Army, you know, the light infantry of it. And for me, it was just an awesome adventure. Now, keep in mind, this is peacetime, you know, and it's easy to beat your chest about, you know, going to war during peacetime and no one's shooting at you. But – you know, for me, I had nothing to compare it to. So I'm like, this is absolutely great. I'm doing all this great hard training. I'm pushing myself to the limits. This is absolutely just more than I could have dreamed of. Truly, I'm like, I'm digging it all the way home every day. It's really pretty cool, except that during my first 3 years in service, two things happened. First, the Gulf War kicked off. Or no, excuse me. First, Panama happened. We invaded Panama, you know, in December 20th of 1989. And I was in Ranger school, actually, when that happened. So missed that. And on top of that, my unit, the 10th Mountain Division, didn't deploy to Panama. So we were kind of 0-for-1 in real world deployments. And then after that, the Gulf War happened. And, you know, everybody in the world is going to go over and kick the shit out of Saddam Hussein, except for the 10th Mountain Division. And so we're basically watching this all on TV. So we're 0-for-2 and going to war. And, man, that puts a really bad taste in an infantryman's mouth that you get left out of going to the show.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point that you make as well, because I've had a few members of special operations and special forces on the show who their career was either side of 2001. So, yep. And it's always interesting to see what their training looked like before and then what their training looked like after. So when you were leading up to that, was any of the training preparing you in the right way for what ultimately you would see in Somalia?
The short answer, yes. I would absolutely say that without a doubt. The short answer is yes. I all the Army training, and a part of this also, James, I do have to say, at the time I didn't realize it because you're a young jackass and you don't really understand the process through which the Army, and I couldn't talk about the Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, but certainly the Army training process is actually very well thought out, very performance-oriented, programmatic and progressive. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. And again, at the time, I didn't realize it, but looking back, it absolutely was very methodical in learning the basics moving up to what we eventually would do in wartime. Now, the comma but is it wasn't until I left the conventional Army and got into the Special Operations Command in the 75th Ranger Regiment that the training was much more acute in detail and complexity that really started testing the skills and training on the skills to a higher level of proficiency that would actually be, what's the word? You know, that you would actually fall back on in combat. And I have to just say one more thing on that. I know I say one more thing a lot. That's not a backhand compliment to the conventional army, nor to the 10th Mountain Division. You know, listen, you got a division of 25,000 soldiers and a limited budget, you know, for guns and ammo for everybody. And then you go down to a unit that's in aggregate, you know, got 3,000 people with the same budget. You get a shit ton more training accomplished, you know, in a smaller unit with a big budget, I guess is where I'm going. And so that magnifies the or punctuates the same army training process. It's just you get a lot more, you know, you have a lot more training aids and opportunities, you know, to travel and train and practice again, you know, just to prepare for whatever might happen somewhere down the road in some distant land when we get the call.
Yeah, and you hit on a point that I've talked about before, and that's why I do like comparing police fire, you know, to special forces, special operations, because, you know, we especially you know, firefighters, we don't know what the hell we're going to be called to. It could be a fire, it could be a cardiac arrest, it could be a plane in a tree. I mean, you know, school shooting. And so there's this array of skills that we need to be on top of. And so I think there's two areas there. As far as who employs us, I think that bar needs to be set very, very high to get the men and women that are able to do that. But as you also mentioned, there needs to be an understanding that there needs to be a budget and a support, you know, and a work schedule that's going to create an environment where these men and women can train to the level they need to. And also to not be exhausted, to thrive when they actually have to go out there and do their job.
Well, absolutely. Listen, there is you can only, you know, you can only crack that whip on racehorses so much before they can't run any faster. You know, you just can't. You can't run them to death, even though they are willing and able and will do it until the end. They can't be. They've got to be managed. They've got to be led. And I think that is a problem. Listen, you can just read the newspaper on any given day. You know, after 17 years of war, you know, our special operations command in general is really worn down. And, you know, some of the problems you see, you know, we start, you know, there's some attrition problems and there's some broken system problems. And, you know, gosh, if manpower starts to leave, then we need to grab more people. And if you grab more people, you know, naturally the standards may lower a little bit. And, you know, so it's this dog wagging the tail sometimes of, you know, you just can't run them to death. You can't, or else the whole thing's going to collapse.
Yeah. And then, and like you said, the budget, having the best equipment and the budget for the training, which is something that I had your fellow Ranger Tim Kennedy in town a little while ago. I did his sheepdog response class.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, comparing what they're teaching just in 2 days with the unarmed combat and the way they teach weapons versus how I'm sure many law enforcement departments are taught just in a range shooting paper targets. And then, you know, maybe in the academy, they learn some unarmed stuff. You realize that you need to have so much more training, and that is going to require a budget. It's just simple economics.
Yep. Absolutely. And no matter what we like to think, it ain't unlimited.
No, exactly. And that's where then, you know, the responsibility goes on the citizens, of which you and I are also taxpayers. So we're not, you know, pointing our fingers at other people, but the priorities need to be that they are told what, you know, the military, the police, the fire, EMS are actually expected to do. And therefore, instead of selling budget cuts to the public, they need to be educated and say, look, for an extra, you know, few pennies out of your paycheck, when they show up on your children's worst day, they're going to be as well prepared as they can possibly be.
Absolutely. And listen, not to go down that rabbit hole too much, but, you know, every time I pass a fat cop, I'm just thinking, could you actually catch a bad guy if he was holding my daughter, you know, in a run? Like, could you do that? You know, could you take a shot at 15 meters? You know, when's the last time you went to the range shooting paper targets or not? When's the last time you were, you know, I start thinking, I look at him all the time tactically, and I think, man, I'm not sure as a taxpayer we're getting our, you know, our money's worth with all these guys, because clearly they ain't catching anybody anytime soon.
Yeah.
And that, in a foot race.
No, and that's a complete reality. And the same with the very, very small, you know, police officers, firefighters. Are they training to be as strong? Are they, you know, in the jiu-jitsu gym all the time? And some of them are, and they're able to perform incredibly well. But that ownership is the other side that I talk about a lot here. Yes, we need to, you know, be given a good environment to thrive by the employer, but the ownership of yourself. So in the Ranger Regiment, you know, how high was that bar set, and what did you do to weed out the ones that had no right being there?
Yeah, so listen, it's my first introduction, you know, when, let me just back up for a second, you know, when you were asking me about, you know, how competitive I was, you know, as an athlete or how good an athlete, you know, at a high school level, that's kind of our first, generally speaking for all of us, that's our first introduction to, you know, you pass fail. You had the skills to make the team. You did, or you didn't have the skills and you didn't. Like, that was it. You know, there was no middle area. It's either your name made the roster or you didn't. And, you know, I was at the time fortunate enough that, you know, I did make the varsity basketball team. And but where I'm going with this, you get out to the Army and the standards are certainly a lot higher than the normal high school, but they're not that high. They're not impossible to meet. And, you know, but once you get into the Army, if you keep your nose clean and your head above water, you know, generally speaking, you're going to be okay. You know, you can plot along at a comfortable level and really not be that challenged. And that's just the fact. You get into this next command, the next echelon, the special operations world and the Ranger Regiment, where the standards are demonstrably higher. And not only are they higher in writing, they're actually enforced. So now you've got to pass through a couple of hurdles, you know, these selections to figure out if you, one, got the talent, the skills, the heart, the motivation, the drive, and, you know, and the knowledge and wherewithal to do it. So that natural process weeds out, you know, some of the riffraff, so to speak. And then you have that constant challenge of not just meeting, but exceeding those high standards and being held accountable. And, oh, by the way, you're in a unit that is this self-licking ice cream cone of accountability and responsibility. So everybody's constantly nipping at your heels to, you know, succeed. And I mean that. I do believe in my heart it was always for the greater good and not from a, you know, trying to see somebody fail. But, you know, this competition to – who's going to be the main effort? Who's going to be the tip of the spear always? And, you know, if you're not first, you're last kind of mentality, well, that goes a long way in the culture of the unit. It's not to say it's perfect. Listen, there you meet people everywhere in the most elite units of our military, and you're like, how on earth did you get in there? You're just a shitbag. Like, you might be really strong, but you might be really good marksman or something, but you're just an asshole. Like, you're just not a good guy. Every once in a while, they get through the system. It just happens. But I think, by and large, in all honesty, I think if you canvass the ranks, you would find that, you know, the further you progress within that command and that special operations community, it sort of naturally levels it out, that the people that are just trying to showboat, generally speaking, they don't last and they're not going to make it.
Yeah, and that speaks a lot for keeping that bar high. And we've got departments out there that do that probably don't have any of the fat cops, as you said. And then I know very personally of ones where the bar has basically fallen off the rack and is lying on the floor. Actually, it fell in a trench below the floor. And, you know, people, you know, will get their unions to fight any annual physical test. And, you know, you end up with exactly what you're talking about. Your kids just died because they couldn't do their job.
Absolutely. And listen, I by no means would I presume to know the inner workings of the police department, the fire department. I've spoken certainly to enough law enforcement at local, state, and federal level to understand that complexity with union and, you know, we're not going to have this, you know, the physical fitness standards or the marksmanship standards or whatever. And I for the life of me, I just can't understand it. I don't know how anybody that carries a gun, for instance, and not to bag on the boys and girls in blue by any means. I love them, but I don't know how anybody that carries a sidearm is not scared shitless every single day, thinking about what happens if I have to draw this weapon, you know, and put two in the chest and one in the head of a bad guy. You know, could I do that? You know, just like that. Could I run to the sound of gunfire and pull that trigger? That would be frightening to me to think that that's what's expected, and I don't know how to do it. Like I can't even fathom that. But I suspect that there are some cultures within that community that are allowing that, if not promoting it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the problem is, as we mentioned earlier, if you are able to climb the ladder with either a lack of knowledge or even a fear of the profession that you're in, whether it's the administrative ladder or even the union ladder, and you're scared of being challenged physically or with your skills, then now you're in a very dangerous place where you're able to enact the very things that are going to make the environment that you're trying to protect actually a lot more dangerous.
Yep. Yep, spot on, man. And that is, listen, at the end, this is me being somewhat philosophical, you know, after only four cups of coffee this morning. But, you know, you wonder every day when somebody gets up and, you know, scrapes their face or brushes their fangs, are they looking in the mirror thinking, you know, I'd like to just be average today. You know, I just want to be, you know, second best today. In my mind, I can't comprehend that. Like, I can't comprehend somebody that's saying, like, I'm quite content just to be average. I mean, I joke about living a vanilla life now, but somewhere deep inside my little knucklehead brain, I still like to think I'm a tough guy. But this idea, though, of I don't want to go out and try and be the best today. I don't want to, you know, who does that? Like, how could you function in this particular profession? Of law enforcement and the fire community and say, yeah, you know, I think being average is okay today. Like that's craziness.
Yeah, I absolutely couldn't agree more. And I'm so glad that we kind of talked about this subject for a while. Well, speaking of the tough guy, because, you know, let's be honest, not only were you in, you know, an elite unit, but also you were tested more probably than most units have in our history. But I'd love to kind of get into that area now. So before we talk about your actual deployment and how that kicked off, I would like to just, if you're able to, paint a picture of, you know, what the people of Somalia were going through as far as the famine and what initially America was trying to do to help.
Yeah. So this two couple of things. First of all, in 1992, when I'm on the scene now, I had just left the 10th Mountain Division. I've gotten down to the Ranger Regiment, the 3rd Ranger Battalion in Fort Benning, Georgia, and, you know, learned, drinking through a fire hose, again, no pun intended, of everything about Ranger life. My old unit at the 10th Mountain, the 2nd Battalion, 87th Infantry, deployed shortly after I left to Somalia as part of this UN peacekeeping operation. And I got to be honest, I'm not sure I could have picked out Somalia on the map in early 1992. Well, Somalia, if you just Google it and you can take 3 minutes to read the history, you know, it's a failed state. There's nothing going on in Somalia except that it's the Horn of Africa. It is just right in the perfect location with two deep water ports that if we, the United States, or the bad guy Russians, were going to fight a naval battle in the Indian Ocean, Somalia is a great place to stage, which is probably the only reason anybody really gave a shit about it. And in the early 70s, the Russians really liked Somalia, so the United States was interested in it. And eventually the Russians left and went to, you know, across the border, and the Americans came in and started to help, you know, the Somalis do whatever they could do. They had some, they had some like sugar refining refineries, if I recall. Whatever it was, the U.S. was involved. Fast forward now, here we are in the 90s, you know, decades of civil war, malnutrition, sub-Saharan African life. I mean, it's just a bad spot. The U.S. has long given up on it. And we are watching these, the UN participate in trying to stop the mortality. I mean, it's horrible. And, you've seen the pictures, everybody that's watched the news, over time, you can find it on the internet. Christiane Amanpour, I like to talk about her a lot, but I mean this in a truly flattering sense. She was one of the first that was broadcasting images from Somalia to the whole Western world and showing, these people are dying by the thousands. And, it's really, really gotten out of control. There's no government to support it. It's just tribal warlords / terrorists that are running ragged, letting people die, killing their own. And, anybody with a conscience is called to say, hey, enough is enough. So there's a big UN presence in Somalia in 1992 trying to make a little bit of order out of the chaos there. I really don't want to suck up all the oxygen in the room on this, but two things while you gave me the mic I want to point in as we get into the story. So you got this big humanitarian effort going on in Somalia, and that's everybody would nod their head and say is generally a good thing. All these UN members of the UN are there taking place, helping support it. Everybody's happy that we're all doing good things. But when you look at the United Nations now, the Secretary General was a guy named Boutros Ghali. And this is significant in the history books because he's Egyptian and he hates Mohammed Adid. They don't like the Somalis in general. There's a cultural issue going on. So right off the bat, you've got some motives that are in conflict. The biggest, most prominent warlord in Somalia is this guy, Adid. The big dog in the fight at the UN is Boutros Ghali. They don't like each other. And, oh, by the way, this country where Adid is starving and in chaos. So, the recipe for disaster is already, well in play before Eversman and the rest of these guys get involved. But, setting that stage, James, I think it's important to understand, whatever people think politically about the UN is certainly up for discussion. But in the big picture, I would be remiss if I didn't say, hey, they're trying to move in the right direction. They're trying to do the right thing in this big humanitarian aid. But, as you all know, as everybody that's listening knows, generally speaking, it's clumsy at best and pretty inefficient in general. So that's where what's going on in 1992 is a lot of people rowing hard to try and stop the famine, broker a little bit of peace deal and stop civil war.
Right. And then, so what was it that took you and Delta and the other members of the military that you guys were with to Somalia, that was separate from that mission?
Yeah. So while this whole effort, this humanitarian effort is going on, a group of Pakistani soldiers are ambushed and killed, slaughtered, really, by Mohammed Adid's militia. It's barbaric what they do. They kill these Pakistani soldiers in the broad daylight, right in the middle of the streets. And on top of that, other UN forces, it was proven, had watched it happen and never lifted a finger. And so the Pakistanis asked the United Nations for support afterwards and bringing justice to it. And the United States was the only country that said, we'll help bring the right this wrong. We'll help capture Mohammed Adid. And that's when we put together this Task Force Ranger, of which I was a member, to go to Mogadishu and capture Mohammed Adid. Like that was the mission.
Right. Now, again, people listening, I'm sure, have seen the film. So I don't want, to say, well, Matt, will you tell me every single step of what happened from then? But just very briefly, so what were expectations when you went in on October 3rd? And then if you could kind of lead us through the sequence of things that happened that obviously worked against the initial plan.
Yeah. So now this, and I must say, if you all listeners, firemen and women, and policemen, law enforcement, whoever's listening, I want you to listen carefully, because there's some, I believe, some really valuable points, and I don't mean to be presumptuous that I'm, you know, the gift of the Magi or the Oracle or anything, but you know, pay attention, because we did a lot of things definitely wrong. I did a lot of things definitely wrong, and I made a lot of assumptions that were definitely wrong. So please, you know, to answer your question, James, yeah. So here's the idea. On October 3rd, we know that two of Adid's top guys are going to meet in a pretty bad part of town, and maybe even Adid himself will be there. So we're going to plan this raid to go capture them. The standard is that it's going to take 30 minutes in and out. You read the book or seen the movie, you know that. A couple of days prior to that, however, I myself had been laterally promoted to from the 2IC of our helicopter to the OIC, the officer in charge, because my boss had to go home, was called home on a Red Cross emergency. So here I am, Staff Sergeant Everest, and now the CHOC leader of CHOC 4, which, you know, we do it all the time, this fallout one drill where you assume command or assume charge, the next level up. But now it's in combat. So we're, you know, Matt Eversman has to make, you know, come to reality that now when I make a decision on the battlefield, you know, it's my decision only to support the commander's intent, and on and on and on. Bottom line is, now I have a new responsibility and I have more authority. You all, again, I say you all listen, if you read the book or seen the movie, daylight raid, we're going to go in. We know that it's going to be about a 30-foot fast rope insertion, which, you know, sucks, but it's not horrible. And consequently, in our preparation that day, we made some assumptions. First of all, we thought at daylight raid, going in at 3:30 in the afternoon, we'll be home at 4:30. We don't need our night vision devices, so we didn't bring them. 30 minutes, even though it is Africa and it's really hot. At the time, we had canteens and camelbacks, I think. You know, I don't need two canteens of water, because who's going to have time to drink water? So I took one out because, oh, by the way, I could put 7 30-round, you know, magazines in a canteen pouch. That'll be good. Previously, even with a couple of firefights, guys realized that, hey, the body armor that we had at the time was very ill-fitting for some, and so the back plates were too big, so they take them out. And everyone's like, hey, you know, who's going to get shot in the back? Nobody's going to think about that. So right off the bat, those are four things before we even started this mission that were completely, absolutely incorrect, and we're going to come back and bite us in the ass. My only feeble in this running commentary, my only feeble observation of it all is that, you know, for me, the lesson learned as a leader going back is, you know, you can unwittingly validate a negative. You know what I mean? You can unwittingly, hey, nothing happened because I didn't have my backplate in last time, so I ought to be good. It's all right. It's unnecessary. Well, clearly now you're like, what a stupid logic. But at the time, it made very good sense that at my level, we're not going to get shot in the back. We would get shot in the front, in the chest. So here we are, October 3rd. And before I go on, James, does that make sense? I hope I'm explaining. In my mind, it sounds crystal clear, but
it makes perfect sense. And just to underline, so the mentality that we see a lot in some of the places we work is, well, it's never happened, so therefore it'll never happen. Instead of, it hasn't happened, so therefore the probability of it happening is even greater.
Exactly. Absolutely. No, if you can think it, it'll happen. We'll get to that at the end. So long and short, we the bad guys are the spies show that the bad guys are where they're supposed to be, and we launch on this mission. And again, you know, yours truly is in charge of his helicopter for the first time in combat. And I got into the helicopter, and for the first time, it seems so silly, you know, I put on the headset so I could talk to the pilots, and I didn't even know how to where the push to talk button was. Like, literally, I've got this headset on and I can hear you know, the pilots in my helicopter talking, and I can also hear everybody else on the Hilo Common network talking. Finally, one of the crew chiefs sort of punches me in the arm and shows me the push to talk button, and the pilot's yelling at me. He's like, "Hey, man, are you going to answer me?" I'm like, "Oh my gosh, what an idiot I am!" I mean, silly as it sounds, I didn't even know it because I'd never done it before. Had no reason to ask anybody, but something that simple, man, you can't make any assumptions that the new guy doesn't understand it all. Everybody's got to show him how to do something at least once. So anyway, off we go. 3 minutes flight or so. Start our approach onto the target. And as we're coming up on the timeline, they give us 30-second warning. My helicopter abruptly comes to a halt in the sky. And the pilot says very distinctly, "I can't see shit." Totally not what you want to hear on short final going in on the target. And what had happened, again, on this particular day, on this mission, my helicopter was the last one going in. All the helicopters before that preceded us kicked up so much dust and debris flying so low in that part of town that it was like flying into a sandstorm. And, you know, that ain't a good thing when you're in a helicopter flying, you know, in a city. And so, you know, after some time, we are trying to figure out what to do. There's a big threat of RPGs from the ground. Decisions made, we're going to go in where we are. Boys start to go out, and as the last thing the pilot says to me is, "Hey, we're in the wrong spot. We're about 3 blocks short of your insertion point. Once you get on the ground, move in the direction of flight, and you'll be good." I'm like, "Okay, Roger. You know, nothing you can do about it. You can't argue. You got to go. It's just fog of war kind of stuff." So one sort of big deal here, again, for young leaders of all ages listening, I'm the last one that's going to go in by design onto the rope. And as I'm kneeling on the helicopter floor, I go to adjust, put my goggles on, you know, my eye protection, and the strap that holds the goggles on snaps, you know, Murphy's Law right there. I don't have a backup. So I'm going in this sandy, dusty, you know, sandstorm. Before we even get on the ground, I'm at a disadvantage and I'm the leader without eye protection. I mean, what an idiot. My fault. Totally my fault. You know, I cleaned the lenses, but, you know, the back had dry rotted. I just hadn't, you know, I hadn't done the proper checks, and that was totally no one's fault but my own. But what do? You just keep going. So I get on the rope. I start to slide down, finally get down to the bottom of the rope. And as I'm almost to the ground, I see below me one of my soldiers is already spread out on the ground right at the bottom. And I'm thinking, my gosh, he's already been shot. Like we must already be in a firefight. And I get down. This wounded soldier is lying there. He's bleeding all over the place. He's all banged up. You know, a couple of Rangers are working on him, and I say, "Where'd he get shot?" And they say, "Hey, Sergeant, he didn't get shot. He fell." I'm like, "You got to be shitting me. What do you mean he fell?" And it turns out that Todd Blackburn had, when he grabbed the rope to descend, the helicopter had keeled over a couple of degrees, and he lost control, and he fell off the rope almost 60 feet. And boom, here he is, you know, still alive, but you know, knocking on heaven's door, not to be overly dramatic. So here we are, first day in charge in combat on the ground, and I got a litter urgent casualty. Talk to my radio guy to call for a medevac. The radio doesn't work. We're in the wrong spot. And literally, James, in the first, you know, 20 seconds of being on the ground, those four things happen. We're put in the wrong spot, litter urgent casualty, new comms, and we're now in a firefight. I mean, by now we are getting, you know, shot at from three directions. And I'm like, that's a really bad way to start any kind of a mission. And that's just going on my particular helicopter. There are 19 helicopters, you know, all over this battlefield. And that's just happening to me right then. And I pause for a second to say, you know, this whole battle that you read about and you see in the movie, in one sense, it's a collection of several different battles. You know, everybody's got a different story from a different perspective of fighting all the way, you know, from the time the whole task force inserted till the time it all got out. And clearly, you know, I can only give some commentary about my experience. But, you know, as far as the rest of the battlefield is going on, you know, the assault onto the target building, you know, as I recollect, went pretty well. In fact, you know, not only did they caught the two bad guys that we were after, but there were like 19 other, you know, blacklisted bad dudes that they rolled up that we were going to, you know, we were gonna have to process and evacuate from the target building. Really quickly, because again, this could be a 3-hour discussion. Back at Chalk 4, we have to organize a medical evacuation for this soldier. And instead of the command coming to us, we send an aid and litter team to take Todd Blackburn under fire from our location down to the target building, turn him over to the commander and the senior medic, and then evacuate him from there, which actually goes pretty well. You know, from that point on, as the whole crux of the story goes, we all are of the understanding that we've got all the bad guys on the target. It's just a question of the commander saying, collapse back to the target and we'll all leave from here when the first Blackhawk gets shot down. You know, I mean, kind of our mission had been, I don't want to say complete, but the first part of the mission was accomplished. We got all the people we were after. And as we're preparing for exfil, first helicopter gets shot down by an RPG. So complete change of mission now. The focus becomes getting to that first crash site, picking up all the survivors and the wounded and, you know, dead if there are any, and then extracting, which in my mind, you know, was not, believe it, as silly as it sounds, I wouldn't have thought that would be, I don't want to say as difficult because that sounds really naive, but it seemed like just something like, you know, I'd seen helicopters crash before where people walked off of it, you know? So I'm like, hey, you know, the helicopter crashed. Now we'll just have to drive over to pick them up. We'll put a thermite on the helicopter and we'll leave from there. Well, clearly, as you all know, if you've watched the movie or seen the book, it's not that easy. Lot of bad guys in town, huge firefights going on all around us. While this focus of getting to the crash site is starting, unbeknownst to us, the second helicopter piloted by Mike Durant comes in to provide security. And as Mike's flying over the battlefield, he takes an RPG. And while it's not catastrophic, it's enough that sends him, you know, on his way back to the airfield to DX's his bird and get another one to come back. And somewhere as he's flying back to the airfield, he has a catastrophic failure and crashes the bird. And now we've got two Blackhawks down. We've already deployed our search and rescue bird. We already have our ground forces moving in one direction. We've already called up our reserves from the airfield. We've alerted the UN, like everything's in motion. And we've got this new helicopter crashed with kind of no one left to go insecure. So, I mean, it's gotten really shitty really quickly. And, you know, to kind of finish this quick narrative, as you all may know, this story was written because of the actions of really three men, three Delta snipers that were flying overhead that watched all this happen, saw Mike Durant's helicopter crash away from the main battle site and immediately said to the commander, put us in. And the commander said, no, we can't put you in because can't lose another helicopter, do what you can from above. And as the story goes, they asked a second time later on to go in and the commander said no. And finally on the third time with the crowd building, the commander said, okay, well, we'll put you in and we'll get a force to you when we can, or words to that effect. And so as this helicopter is making its approach, it takes fire. Brad Hollings, one of the Delta snipers that's on the board, is shot. Gary Gordon and Randy Shugart are able to deploy, get in, fight their way up to the helicopter. And as you know, only survivor of that crash is the pilot, Michael Durant. And he's pretty banged up. He's in bad shape. So they move him to safety, cannibalize all the weapons, and then hold their position as long as they can until they are, you know, sadly overrun by the enemy and are killed, protecting Mike Durant. And as everyone knows, Mike has been captured by a deed, which really sort of changes the whole, you know, ending to this story. Just a quick other aside, the first helicopter that's crashed, unfortunately, when this helicopter crashes, the nose of the helicopter folds over the cockpit, and so the bodies of the two pilots have to be, you know, the pilot, the helicopter has to be, taken apart, deconstructed in order to evacuate the bodies. And that's the reason the task force in general is in overnight, because we're not going to leave, you know, we're certainly not going to leave anybody, let alone an American pilot, member of our task force, you know, into the enemy's hands. This whole story, you know, at the end, though, James, you know, it's a sad story in one sense. It's an amazing story in another as a participant. But finishing all out, and I'll let you jump in and ask some more questions. You know, eventually, Michael Durant is repatriated, you know, a couple of weeks later after being held by Mohammed Adid. Adid basically brokered, for lack of a better word, a peace deal. He brokered a way out of it. And our forces were sent home. You know, I mean, that was it. We finished that battle, captured the bad guys, repatriated our bodies, and then politically the decision made to leave Somalia and come home. On the good side of this story, beyond just the amazing stories of valor and bravery and tenacity and just American will, you know, Gary Gordon and Randy Shukart, the two Delta snipers who were killed protecting Michael Durant, were awarded posthumously the Medal of Honor. And that was the most incredible thing, to literally say that we were in the company of those kinds of heroes, you know, in a shithole country that nobody cared about. And yet they gave everything they possibly could, protecting one of their own in the worst situation. I mean, that's, of all the narratives, of all the stories, of all the lenses, you know, the story of Gary Gordon and Randy Shugart and Brad Hollings is, you know, to this day, just an incredible picture of the greatest things that Americans do, because at the end, you know, doing the right thing for the right reason in a bad spot.
Obviously, you've just, you know, what you just said in the last 20 minutes or so, there are a million things that I could talk about. But I think one of the things that really struck me was, well, firstly, as you were saying, so there you were, you know, your unit before not seeing a lot of action. And then, you know, when you're deployed, you come to pretty much a worst case when it comes to combat. You got a, you know, vastly outnumbered, thousands and thousands and thousands of Somalians, a lot of them hopped up on drugs that time of day as well. But the, as you said, the kind of heroism is the word that you like or not, but the courage of the Delta snipers, for example, knowing that they were most likely going to die when they went down, when the guys went back to the base, bringing the casualties and then, you know, got new ammunition and then drove back out there again, knowing that they were probably not going to make it. That's the one thing that I see. And again, it's falling back on that training and also the kind of men that the organizations that you belong to had found first, because obviously, you know, you weren't just made, you were found and then trained. That sense of brotherhood, that come hell or high water, even if you ended up dying, that you were going to be there for the man you're right and the man you're left, is really what I got from that whole story.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it is a you know, it's a story of combat. I mean, it's a story of the brothers in arms. It's the esprit de corps. It's everything that you just mentioned. that is shared and born out of the Crucible experience, for sure.
The last part of the film as well, the Mogadishu Mile, you guys were left to the point where they had to basically run that last mile. There's some narrative spoken in the documentaries and I guess suggestion in the film as well, where the Somalis at one point let you guys, you know, didn't give resistance towards the end. Do you think that was a thing, as it were, or do you think you'd actually by that point worn them down so much that they didn't even give chase?
You know, that's a good question, and I couldn't give the empirical answer. I do know now, so just quick fact, I actually got out, I myself, the real Matt Eversman, got out in a vehicle the night before. So that you see in the movie with Sergeant Eversman running, that was not me. The reality, though, is that, you know, there was like this imaginary, and this is just my observation of being in the city and then on the way out of the city, there was like this imaginary demarcation line where all of a sudden, like on one side of the street, everybody was shooting, and then literally you'd go a block and nobody would shoot, nobody being the bad guys. So I think that there was probably a little bit of that. I think also, listen, there were a lot of, you know, nobody likes to say this in a chest beating way, but, you know, I mean, we put a lot of damage on Adid's militia that day. I mean, there was just absolute, you know, this was a violent, violent day. For them, the estimates I read afterwards were there were like 10,000 armed Somalis, you know, 150 American trigger pullers on the ground, and you know, the staggering the numbers of enemy that were killed and wounded. It was just unbelievable. So I believe also there was this notion that Adid realized, hey, I've got a soldier. We don't need anything else because this is gonna be our bargaining chip. As it turned out, he was pretty smart in doing it that way. And I also think they were attrited to the point they couldn't fight anymore. And again, I don't mean that to sound like, you know, the juvenile chest beating bravado, but I do believe that, you know, literally they couldn't fight anymore. Listen, you know, for all the enemy's actions, it would have been so easy for them while our force was in the city to just go invade the airfield. You know, I mean, you think, why didn't they just go take over the airfield? It wasn't that strongly armed. It wasn't that strongly defended. If they controlled the airfield, you know, where are we going to go? You know, where are we, the guys in the city? They would have been able to kill every single one of us had they taken over the airfield, which they, you know, ostensibly could have done, but I don't think they could have because they didn't have the bodies and they didn't want to fight. So the long rambling answer, it's just my one guy's opinion. I think it's a little bit of all of that all wrapped in. I just think that they probably realized afterwards they no mas for them.
Yeah. Well, I know that we got to be, you know, cognizant of time. I know you got a call coming soon. But I want to touch on one thing. And it, again, as a first responder and then putting myself in the shoes of you and your men out there, you weren't fighting, you know, like Nazi Germany, where you've got opposing uniforms and it's, you know, men of your age facing you the other side of the trenches, as it were. But you had women and children, you know, with AKs actively shooting at you. What was the psychological trauma for you like once you came home after that all sank in?
None. And again, I don't mean to be glib about it. None. I think this idea, and I've always tried to explain it like this to people, you know, the first lesson you learn, or that I should say you, the, one of the most dramatic yet simple lessons I learned when this task force started to train to go to Mogadishu, one of the Delta guys said, no matter what, look at their hands. Doesn't matter who it is, look at their hands. People can't harm you if they got nothing in their hands. So look at their hands. That's where their weapon's going to be. And it seems so simple. And I'm like, wow, that makes sense. Nobody told me that. So using that idea now, it becomes, hey, that, let's just start at the big picture. There is somebody with a weapon in their hands. that means they want to do me harm. And then the second kind of graduation in this exercise is man, woman, or child, am I going to willingly let them shoot the soldier to my right or left or myself because they're a woman and child that means to do me harm? And the answer, of course, is no, you can't. Like, you just nobody gets a pass at killing one of our comrades because they're a woman or child. Like, that's nonsensical. So the answer to that question, you know, I think it's one of those that plays out great in the psychology books, but at the end of the day, you know, people are just as dead whether they're on the, you know, a 15-year-old shooting you or an 85-year-old shooting you, man, woman, or child. It doesn't matter. You're just as dead if they shoot you.
Yeah, and that's actually great for the law enforcement people listening, because I'm sure that, you know, sometimes they have that exact problem, you know, they're faced with on the streets.
Absolutely. Now, and listen, now the psychology, and again, I don't want to be so glib that, you know, being in a gunfight doesn't have an effect on the person in that gunfight. That's all sort of the whole second story of how we do come back, how we go through grief, how we go through the re-entry into normal life and dealing with the psychology of it all, which is way many pay grades above me, other than my armchair quarterback, you know, Lucy Van Pelt, you know, psychology is, you know, faith, family, friends. Maybe not always in that order, but those are the three things how I dealt with it after getting home from the battlefield. You know, that was my support network. And sometimes it was just faith. Sometimes it was whoever my closest friend was nearby to talk to, or the support of my family always. But that was sort of my answer ultimately. How do you deal with all this stuff at the end? That's how it is.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for that. Well, I'll make sure that we also talk about your projects that you have coming up. A fascinating one for me is your new documentary, Send Me. So if you wouldn't mind telling people about that and when we can anticipate it.
So thanks, James. So listen, I, you know, these things in life, just always be open to opportunity. And when we moved down here to Florida, I randomly walked into a gentleman who became a very good friend of mine, a guy named Tim Malloy, who had been a career journalist, a broadcast journalist. And he had also embedded multiple times since the beginning of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he had, you know, said to me, he's like, you know, we should go over, you know, at some point and do a show about, you know, the advances in battlefield medicine since Somalia. And, you know, seems sort of like far-fetched, but eventually we were able to do it. And man, we had a great show. Hey, James, I just got to pause 1 second and just let the dogs in. Can you hold on for 1 sec? Sorry about that. We have these two knucklehead Labradors, and they just are keep you beaten. And these just start scratching. No. So anyway, we had this opportunity that Tim put together earlier this spring to go travel with the Air Force to Landstuhl, Germany, and then to Bagram Air Force Base, and then out to Jalalabad, Afghanistan, and just spend some time with all the different stages of medical units along the path. So as it turns out, we got to this outpost in Jalalabad, and just literally within an hour of an Afghan soldier stepping on an IED. And we were able to follow like the entire journey from the point of impact where this commando was injured, but literally from the dust off landing to the first trauma center, all the way back from Bagram to all the surgical units. I mean, it was fascinating. And we were able to capture all this and put it into this documentary that we have called Send Me. And, you know, it's all about the service of these great young men and women, from the enlisted medics to the docs on the battlefield, you know, working at these class two trauma centers, all the way up to, you know, the biggest hospitals in Landstuhl. So we're hoping to have this We had originally hoped to have it out this coming October, or sometime around October 3rd or 4th with the 25th anniversary, but we've had to do some re-edits, of which is way out of my pay grade, that I don't understand, or I just nod my head to. So I'm hoping probably towards the end of next month it'll be out. It's probably going to start on PBS, but absolutely we'll keep you posted. I've seen some of the rough scripts or the rough pictures, and I must admit, despite my face for radio, it's a pretty neat documentary. And most importantly, not only have we advanced a lot, and we are saving a lot more lives, and you know, where it's critical how you know, to emphasize how well our young men and women, particularly in the medical communities, have done, and what they're doing on the battlefield. It's just incredible. But probably more important than that, James, is, you know, this is a reminder. We just filmed this, you know, a few months ago in 2018, and a lot of people need to remember we still have soldiers deployed, and they're still in harm's way, and there are still bad people out there that mean to do us harm. And that can't be forgotten either. So we saw it as a two-floor, you know, a two-part operation. One, to show how great our medics and medical teams are doing, and two, to remind America that we still have great men and women that are downrange, you know, doing bad things to bad people for us.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see it. It sounds incredible, and obviously it would be very pertinent for the medics out there listening, even if they're in the civilian side, not the military side.
Absolutely. Listen, you know, and I'm sorry, I've kind of hogged up all the conversation talking about me, but you know, as you and I were chatting before we started, you know, the similarities are so, you know, between our professions are exactly, they're just so similar. And you know, while maybe not every medic or fireman, you know, is running, you know, has somebody shooting at him, though I suspect that that does happen too. You know, the dealing in the crucible, doing your job in the crucible, and particularly when ultimately it is about saving lives. You know, we got to always be, like you said, we always are preparing for the worst constantly, because I'm telling you, if you can think it, it can happen. And when it happens, trying to learn on the job ain't the way to do it.
Yeah, well, I would love if it's okay to do a part two, because I know we've run out of time, but I've got so much more I'd love to ask you if you have some more time in the future.
Yeah, James, listen, absolutely. And I'm sorry that I should have told you that up front, that I had a little bit of a hard stop this morning. But, man, please let me know when I could come back on. Again, we can bore people.
No one's going to be bored. So very quickly, though, I know you do public speaking as well. So where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
Yeah, so listen, first of all, you can go to Eversman Advisory, all one word, .com. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. And clearly, they can find me through your links. But yeah, shoot me a note at matt@eversmanadvisory.com. I'm happy to chat, help, whatever I can do. Find us on the web or certainly on LinkedIn. Would look forward to chatting with anybody.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I will let you go, but I am looking forward to reconnecting in the future as well.
Absolutely. Hey, James, thank you so much, my friend. I appreciate all you're doing. And, you know, I hope if our paths will cross in person one of these days on the east coast of Florida. But thanks for all you do. And you be safe. And everybody listening, you know, check your six, keep your powder dry. And, you know, I hate to say this because it galls me to give the SEALs credit, but they really do have a great saying when they said the only easy day was yesterday. And that really is magnificent. And of course, I say that with love for, you know, our Navy brothers. But yeah, the only easy day was yesterday. So get after it.